Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. My name is Lindsay Rowntree. I'm head of content at ExchangeWire. You haven't heard me in this seat for quite a while, but it's nice to be hosting again. And I'm joined today by Kieran O'Kane, CEO of ExchangeWire. Hello, Kieran.
Great to have you back, Lindsay.
It's great to be back. I haven't been on the podcast for a few weeks. I miss it immensely.
It's good crack.
And our special guest today is Rich Ashton. And Rich Ashton is managing partner of First Party Capital. Rich, great to have you here.
Hey, Lindsay. Yeah, pleasure to be on. Listened to the podcast for a long time, so great to be invited to join you guys today.
Awesome. Well, without further ado, let's kick off. We've got some good stories today. First of all, our best story is, of course, Google News. So Google have dropped another privacy-related bombshell, and they've announced they will not build alternate identifiers to track individuals. So for anyone using Chrome to replace third-party cookies, they will instead be using privacy-preserving APIs to fuel their online advertising products once the digital tracker becomes obsolete on Chrome by February next year. It means that the ads platform will no longer support the use of any form of identifier, such as unified IDs and hashed email addresses, for any targeted form of advertising. Because they don't consider these technologies to be sustainable long-term investment. They believe with all the different regulations going around globally, there's no point in trying to build something short-term, and they're looking at this from a long-term perspective. And they believe there's still a lot of distrust amongst consumers towards targeted advertising, and that is the main reason behind their decision. But of course, there's been some backlash, and many commentators don't believe that to be true. So, I mean, there's lots of questions here. Like, are you surprised by Google saying this? Do you believe that this is Google saying goodbye to ad tech and trying to basically stamp out ad tech as we know it today? And also, I'm interested in your perspectives on how you thought the industry reacted to this. Were you surprised by how the industry reacted? Because there was some severe backlash and some people lost their heads a bit in terms of their responses. So I'm very interested to hear your views on that. So I'm going to start with you, Rich, and get your thoughts on all of this.
Yeah, sure. So I guess on first read, it seemed like, you know, it wasn't too surprising. We all knew that the cookie was going to be deprecated. But then as I think you dug into some of the points that maybe weren't mentioned, that's when some of the surprises started to come out. And to your point, the likes of Oracle have been extremely vocal and basically calling out Google. On one side, you know, it looks like they're very much building those walls even higher around their own walled gardens and not doing anything to actually change how they operate. They talk about it as being very much a consumer privacy play, but it seems that actually across their own properties, nothing's particularly changing in that regard. And then on the other side, you know, Jeff Green from the Trade Desk, despite his share price dropping a fair bit off the announcement, actually came out and said he sees it as a very good day for the open internet. And he thinks that long term, the Trade Desk and the Unified ID 2.0 will continue to be a success. So, yeah, it's very interesting to see the different angles there and how it will play out.
And this is it, right? It feels, at first glance, it feels like, oh, my God, this is the worst news in the world, but it shouldn't have been a surprise for anybody, as you just said, Rich. But if you dig into it, does this actually provide us with some great opportunities, Kieran?
Lindsay, this is the greatest day ever in ad tech. Today is the greatest day ever in ad tech because it's another day. But last week was a great day for ad tech. We have now been cut from the umbilical cord of Google. And I guess, look, first and foremost, to echo Rich's opinion there, it's amazing how people were surprised by this. Why are you surprised if Google, who after telling you they were going to do it, end up doing it? Like, I mean, please, stop your crying, right? And Google's doing it because of Google, right? They are making a conscious decision to kind of retreat from the open internet and third-party ad tech because there's a couple of reasons. First of all, they're saying it's privacy, but you know, who knows if it's just a ruse to kind of just solidify their market share. But the other reason is probably shrinking margins in that space versus their other core businesses like search and YouTube and all the other stuff they have, like 100% margin in YouTube, and that they're going to look after Google. They don't really care about ad tech. They don't really care about the ecosystem in general. They care about Google. And privacy brings all the problems to them as well in terms of third parties, right? Because Google is at risk for falling foul of any privacy legislation, which could result in massive fines to the company, which is a reduced revenue numbers, because a lot of the laws here in Europe takes a percentage of the overall revenue globally. So that's Google, right? For our industry, it is an opportunity to reframe what we've done for the last 10, 15 years, right? Getting away from Google and reimagining how our space works in a privacy first world, right? Around measurement, around targeting. And, you know, that's a huge opportunity for all of the startups coming through who are thinking, you know what, Google doesn't exist anymore. Think about it this way. If you think that Google just doesn't exist and you've got to build for war without Google, you're going to be in a much stronger place going forward. I know that Google have Flock, which is a pile of shit. Like, let's be honest, Google's making up stuff as it goes along, and they're the only arbiters in that situation. So who's going to say they're right or wrong in terms of what? Say, oh yeah, Flock works. Says who? Says Google? Yeah, who's sort of like auditing that? But for our industry, it's a great opportunity to kind of rethink this space, you know, around first-party data, around contextual, around clean rooms. There's so much great technology we can use to innovate around Google, right? And I think it's a great day. Look, if you've built your business on top of Google, then you're in trouble. If you're building an ID that's trying to hack privacy, you're in trouble. So I think it's a great day for the consumer and a great day for ad tech and digital media space in general.
So Ciaran, you mentioned there some of the companies that might be in trouble with Google's news, but you also mentioned the likes of ID, the likes of data clean rooms, the likes of Context. Rich, I'm interested in what you think, who out of the gate off this news is onto a winner here. What kind of companies out that exist in the ad tech space are onto a good thing with the Google news and can see themselves probably benefiting massively from this new news from Google?
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, it's been interesting speaking with founders over the last 3 months, particularly those that are playing in the first party data space, cookieless targeting, and other sort of innovative solutions that are building for the next 10 years and have very much built the business in the knowledge that these type of announcements were going to be made, and obviously the privacy changes that have been happening over the last few years. So to Ciaran's point, anyone that is still, I guess, pretty early on in their journey and has been building for this world from scratch in that first party data space in particular should be pretty well placed to navigate the changes that are coming up. Interestingly, one thing I guess that hasn't been touched on is maybe the agency's involvement in this. I think obviously they've been losing power to a certain extent with in-housing, and maybe this gives them an opportunity to actually provide value to brands who are going to be quite confused about the different options and the different sort of tracking tools and ID solutions. So perhaps this is an opportunity for some of those agencies to add a lot of value in terms of their knowledge of what might be next as regards to ID solutions available.
That's a very good point. Agencies are in a great place to be able to consult, strategize, manage all these different, they're going to now need a lot of different partners and platforms to work with when they haven't got Google to fall back on. Agencies are really well placed to manage that. And I was going to ask you guys anyway, kind of what you believed outside of ad tech, what this means for the likes of agencies, marketers and publishers. Rich, you've obviously shared a really good insight about agencies. Mm. I mean, and it also ties in with what it means for marketers. Like, will marketers be confused and feel a bit bereft and not know what to do and where to put their budget? You know, how will they be able to operate, and what opportunities are there for marketers that are probably looking, feeling a bit like rabbits in the headlights right now?
Do you know what? Hey, it's really interesting that this situation is like where Google and Facebook probably were the greatest threat to the holding group model or even the agency model. the privacy piece is actually going to basically make holding groups and AIDS even more important, to your point, Rich, and you, Lindsay. Like, the fragmentation in our space, because it's very important that the listeners understand that if Google had done this 4 or 5 years ago, I would say that the industry would have been Daffy Duck, right? It would have been completely screwed because of just the sheer grip that Google had and still has to a certain extent on the industry, right? But the world is completely different from 5 years ago. We have many walled gardens. You know, look at the advent of Pinterest and Snap. And then you've got all your sort of publishers who are building their own sort of first-party solutions. And you've got platforms that are emerging, gaming and social. So the world is it's a much checkered place, right? And I haven't even thrown in the CTV thing or digital at home. So the media landscape is very, very different. And while Google is very powerful, don't get me wrong, across the open internet because of Chrome, because of all the logged-in data, it doesn't have complete control. And that means that, like, the convenience of having that cookie in the browser meant that you could easily do attribution and measurement and all performance. But the world is, as I said, if the complication means that agencies are even more important than they were before, because they're going to help brands to figure out how you buy audiences across these different fragmented pieces and how you build your attribution models. And I guess this is the reason why, full disclosure, I'm also involved in First Party Capital as on the investor committee. But this is the reason why we started, because we think there's going to be a wave of brilliant companies coming through that work with service layer. I actually think the service layer is going to grow and it's going to be very significant in the next couple of years. Because when you don't have those monolithic sort of companies, they'll control certain bits and certain significant parts of the ecosystem. They don't have complete control. And I think this is why Google could probably get away with this, because they're not as strong as they used to be. Don't get me wrong. They still make $200 billion out of digital advertising, which is very significant and will probably grow. But they're not going to get control of CTV and they're not going to get control of digital ad, because no broadcaster in their right fucking mind will let Google get into the hen house after what YouTube has done to them and what they've done to publishers. And likewise, I think publishers are going to find a new breath of fresh air in terms of a new sort of lease of life in terms of their business, because they're the consumer-facing piece. And they're going to have a relationship with the consumers and they're going to have lots of good first-party data. So it's interesting. Those constituent players are going to be interesting. And, okay, marketers are probably the ones who are going to get – are the ones kind of out of kilter here, because, you know, that was a convenient way to buy and measure audiences, buying through Google and buying through Facebook, and still is. But they need to get access to other audiences. They need to get access to first party data. Who's going to operate those clean tech rooms? Who's going to help build them the segments post Google and post privacy in that new area? You know, who's going to bring all this technology to play? Can a brand do? Yeah, bigger brands, surely. Yeah, the big ones, the in-house brands, but even then they're going to need help as well. So I'm very bullish on the service. I'm also very bullish on the publishers.
Yeah, hopefully it empowers publishers to, you know, as they're building those audiences with logged in first party data, they're not going to want to rely solely on Google for their data strategy and monetization sources. So hopefully there will be an increasing amount of unique inventory available to the independent ad tech vendors, which brands will have to use to ultimately buy that inventory.
So we all agree publishers are not Daffy Duck. And this represents a massive opportunity for the entire industry. And those companies that have built their companies on the top of Google, you know, this is what you get if you rely on another company within any industry. If you build your company off another company and not independent of anything else, these things will happen. So you kind of have to expect and just kind of like roll with it.
History repeats itself, Lindsay. I mean, there was
absolutely
built off Facebook, and they got like steamrolled by Facebook's innovation around their ad platform and all the rest of it. So you got to learn from the mistakes, and certainly just basing a business off Google, it seems like a good idea because of skill, but the world is a lot more complicated.
Yeah, totally. And fear not, listeners, we will be going more into more detail about what first party capital is at the end of the podcast. But next news story, as Kieran went on a classic Google rant there for about 3.5 minutes.
I love Google.
Expected.
Thank you, Google.
Well done, Google. Our next news story is about privacy-centric internet browser Brave, who have announced they are launching their own search engine. Brave Search we built on pre-existing search engine Tailcat, which is an offshoot of the now-defunct German search engine Click, which comes with a ready-made but less granular web index. So Brave founder Brendan Eich says the new search engine will adopt the same default anonymous user model as the Brave browser and will not collect IP addresses nor track or profile any of its users. However, Eich has revealed that some users will be able to opt into anonymous data collection if they want to have their search results improved. The company actually plans to launch the browser. You can currently join the waitlist. I did it earlier and fill in a little survey about whether you'd pay for a search engine or not. In the first half of this year, so kind of we're expecting sort of up to July it will launch, and is exploring how it can provide both a paid ad-free search engine, so you pay a subscription model to receive no ads when you use the engine, or an ad-supported alternative, free-to-use alternative at the same time. They're also building a feature called Goggles, which I think is interesting because I think Google might have something to say about that, which will allow users to filter their search results using Brave Goggles, not Google Goggles. But lots of questions here. I think it's really, really interesting. We've been talking about Brave a lot over the past few years and what their moves have been. Obviously, Brave are known as the kind of the privacy browser, and now they're going into the kind of the privacy search world as well. You know, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think Brave are going down the right path by trying to enter the search world? It'll be available not just as a default search engine in the Brave browser, but also as an alternative engine in any other browser. So you can use Brave Search in Chrome, in Safari, anywhere else. But what do you believe the future of this could be? Do you believe that there's enough of a draw here from the likes of a search engine like Brave or alternatives like Neva, which was recently, it is also in development by two ex-Googlers, another subscription-based search engine. Do you think that there's enough of a draw here for users that will leave Google and the ease of Google to go and try out new privacy-focused, privacy-first search engines? Rich, what's your perspective on this?
Yeah, fascinating timing on this one. And for better or worse, we'll probably end up talking a lot about Google in this next section.
I expect so.
Yeah, fascinating to see Brave, who obviously the challenger, privacy first browser, now also challenging Google for the search market. Obviously, Google's dominance across all of those and the mobile operating system market with Android is potentially insurmountable. But I think from a user perspective, this makes a huge amount of sense. It's obviously very much privacy first. And I wouldn't be too concerned about the quantity of search data they have available. Let's be honest, who looks past page one of Google anyway? And I think what's interesting is some of the features that they're looking to roll out around actually filtering search results. As you say, the product name Goggles is very questionable, but the actual functionality you can imagine, perhaps, you know, filtering media stories based on independent media outlets or filtering products based on local stores or ethical brands. I think there's a huge amount of innovation that can happen within the search functionality. Clearly, scale is going to be an issue. The company that they acquired struggled, I think, to get more than a few hundred thousand users. But given that Brave already has, I think, 25 to 30 million monthly active users, hopefully they can actually start to achieve a reasonable amount of scale with their search engine to start with. So I think from a user perspective, it makes a lot of sense. I have questions around the adoption from brands and from publishers and how that ultimately works through the crypto monetization. Our publishers going to want to receive bats rather than fiat. It's a really interesting space, but certainly from a user perspective, I think it's a very exciting one. And looking at Brave's roadmap, I understand they're also looking to launch a video conferencing service. So you could start to imagine a almost WeChat style super app platform where they're getting involved in the other areas of online experience, who knows, potentially e-commerce in future. And if they can start to do that, then I think, yeah, it does become a very compelling challenger to the Google domination.
That's interesting. I'm ill-equipped. I didn't realize that about the video conferencing service, but you raise a great point about it going down the kind of the super utility app route, which, you know, which many companies outside of APAC sort of try and fail to kind of get to that stage. But you see the likes of Line and WeChat and Viber even that are popular in APAC and Eastern Europe do very, very well on that space. So I wonder, yeah, it's a very interesting point. Could Brave enter that area and go further into going beyond a browser, almost into sort of Google territory, delivering multiple different types of products. Kieran, you seemed very excited about this when you first saw it. What are your thoughts on Brave going into search?
I think I really like Brave. I mean, just some sort of background on it. Like, Brendan Eich obviously is the inventor of JavaScript, which is basically a framework for most of website development in the world. Like, because he's a genius, and obviously he was at Firefox and had his problems there when he left. But you know, Brave for me is kind of one of those under the radar ad tech companies that nobody talks about. Like, I have a very different view of ad tech than most people, but they're a first party platform. Effectively, they have a community of 30-40 million people. I use their browser. It's very, very good. It's very quick, not bloaty. And I feel that I just feel very uncomfortable with Google having that much data around. I can see how they could chip away at this and build, you know, they could get to 100 million or maybe 200 million because people would just start using the browser. And they removed it. Like, their ICO was interesting, the initial coin offering. So they have. So they're built on remuneration around crypto. So they have invented their own token, which was the basic attribution token, which I believe has a market value of 500 million or something to that effect, and is used within the system. So basically, advertisers buy it and publishers are remunerated in it, and then there's extra tokens for users to watch advertising, right? So there's a whole ecosystem of this. I know it might sound a bit crazy because obviously publishers want to get paid in fiat money, but it's starting to gather traction. And as we move to a more comfortable scenario where we're happy using crypto or being paid in crypto, and the one thing that Brave managed to do, which many other tokens haven't, they've kind of stabilized the price. It doesn't really fluctuate the way that Bitcoin has, or but it rises up, but it doesn't have those mad daily changes in price, which is very, very interesting. I think that them going into search just makes a lot of sense. It's just the users don't want to use Google, and clearly they see an opportunity for them to keep them in the browser, and almost they have the privacy forced antithesis to Google system, where they're not using the data to kind of accelerate their growth. They're using the privacy force. So yes, I think this is amazing. A company. I always bemoan the fact they keep hiring crazy privacy advocates or zealots as their spokesperson. I'd rather they hadn't hired little Johnny, because actually I think that Brave is a really interesting company and deserves probably a more serious people to kind of like lead the messaging on it. Like, I prefer if they kind of get away from that weird kind of bunker, you know, panic bunker, tin-hatted sort of privacy lunatic sort of fringe, and just accept the fact that they're a great platform for the new privacy first age.
I won't delve into those bizarre comments you just made there.
A lot of those people are lunatics. Like, they should be in silence, let's be honest.
Wearing their little tinfoil hats, yeah. But I'm interested as well what your thoughts are. Kieran, you mentioned remuneration for publishers and being paid in BAT versus fiat currency. But also, what about from a consumer perspective? Obviously, Brave do rewarded ad viewing for consumers for you to be in control of your advertising. Can you see them launching something similar, a kind of rewarded ad product for search? Could that be an interesting route for them to go down, or do you not see it working?
That could be quite interesting. But if you look at Google's search results, right? I mean, their search is questionable. It is not great. I mean, you tend to have to trawl through a lot of advertising before you get to anything that's organic. So there is definitely a market to offer that. I'm not really sure. Are you paying on a click basis? It would make sense to kind of like have brands by keywords that people click on, and then that's given to whoever, like, I suppose it's got into Brave's pocket. I'm not sure how that incentivized search thing would work in that instance. I'm trying to figure out in my head. I think maybe this is more of a value add for the actual existing users on the platform, and a bit like DuckDuckGo. DuckDuckGo is purely contextual. And Brave is probably going to be purely contextual, so they're actually being privacy compliant. But the clicks mean there's more revenue in their pocket for them. So, you know, they don't have to share that money with the publishers, because it's all, you know, their own search, effectively their own platform. So I think it's, for me, and just thinking about it, it's actually a great revenue creator for Brave going forward.
And the likes of Neva plan on going down the Google route and trying to integrate with your emails, with your apps, like your calendar, to then show you relevant search results. Could you see Brave as a browser trying to do something similar? I mean, it could tie in with what you mentioned about kind of the super utility aspect of the route Brave's going down. Can you see that being a benefit or something that users would be a bit scared of, given they're trying to remove themselves from like Google's kind of intrusive, intense way of knowing everything about you?
Yeah, my gut reaction to that is that if people are opting to use Brave mainly because of the privacy first nature of it, they might be reluctant to start connecting their emails and calendars and other personal information in order to receive more targeted search results. And the other question mark I have, and you mentioned Neva, is that subscription revenue model for a search engine. That I think would be very challenging. You know, people, I think, are happy to pay a subscription when there's very sort of premium, exclusive content. But for a search engine, when there's obviously such a successful incumbent and free solution, I'd be pretty surprised if people were happy to start paying a monthly subscription to access the internet. Obviously, we've been very conditioned over the last 25 years or so to have free access. So I think rewarded video and sort of rewarded ads are one thing, but I would see considerable challenges in that subscription model that's being proposed by Neva.
Would I, and also proposed by Brave as well. They're trying to do a dual model. So would either of you pay?
No, I mean, no. I think that I'd be prepared to work with DuckDuckGo if they could improve the search results, right? I think that Rich is right around being conditioned. Like there's this subscription, mindset there that everybody's prepared to pay for everything. That's nonsensical because people just don't have infinite amounts of money to pay for search when it's free on Google, on Bing, on DuckDuckGo. And I think it will be very hard. I would prefer if Brave were thinking this is an add-on, a very good add-on for their existing product. If you put in a random keyword in the URL bar, then it's going to show you some results that are of interest to you. And that would make more sense. I just think the subscription idea for search is very odd. I mean, there probably is a small slither of rich people who could probably, who can afford that type of thing, and maybe they want that deep level of integration. But I think people are wary about having all of their information linked into one centralized point. I think most people feel very uncomfortable using Google for everything anyway. I mean, I would personally I think Brave is a really good browser. It's very fast. It's very efficient. And if they had a search engine, I'd probably use it. But it'd be very hard to get people to pay for this,
I think. I must move us on to the last story because we are time is escaping very, very quickly. Unsurprisingly.
Having fun, Lindsay.
Having a great time, of course. fun was had by all. The final story is about TV ad spend from gaming companies, the gaming industry. So the gaming industry experienced a big boost last month after video game companies increased their TV ad spend by 34%. This is according to a report from VentureBeat and iSpot TV. Nintendo led the pack in both spend and airings, accounting for 81.3% of total of the $16.6 million total and accruing 74.1% of all airings. The 81.3% and 74.1% disparity between budget and actual airings is down to investment in Super Bowl. Now, in previous months, Sony have been the winner of TV ad spend, and it seems that Nintendo go a bit wild every February. I'm guessing it's mostly Super Bowl related. But this story is about both gaming and TV advertising. So it's interesting, the gaming investment in TV is always a bit of a misnomer for many people, and can't understand why gaming companies that are so focused on attribution and some of the most advanced industries, if you like, in terms of attribution, why they continue to invest so heavily in the TV space, which is largely, while obviously measurability is massively improving, it's largely still immeasurable in terms of being able to measure linear TV versus connected TV and measure cross devices. Why gaming companies are intent on going into that space, particularly in the linear space? Do they see genuine reward and genuine like recompense from it? And do they actually see good customer acquisition? But also from a TV perspective, and particularly around the event space, the 34% increase was largely down to Super Bowl and the impact that events still have on linear TV advertising spend. And Ciaran, obviously, you're very vocal about, you know, believing that the linear TV is dead and CTV is the way forward. But then you do see these kind of trends that show that there is still so much to be had from linear TV. What are your thoughts around the future of linear TV in this kind of impact, and how we can cross measure both? And if industries like gaming are still investing in it, you know, actually, is there still a lot to be said for the future of TV? Long winded that, I believe, but hopefully you understand where I'm coming from. I'm going to start with you, Ciaran, on this one.
Yeah, I mean, look, Lindsay, I think I've been characterised as an anti-linear TV person. I think that's very unfair. I didn't watch a rugby match on linear TV, and I got ads. I enjoyed those ads.
Oh, but wow!
I think that there's still value in that mass medium solution, which is TV and the audiovisual piece, and TV advertising. It works clearly because the gaming industry wouldn't be investing lots of money in TV ads if it didn't fit their model, right? So clearly they must be running specific attribution around, if you see this ad, how many downloads will happen afterwards. So they'll have some kind of performance-based attribution around it. It won't surely be just building brand equity. It'll be something else that's attached to it. Obviously, maybe there's a disparity in pricing between TV. Maybe TV advertising is relatively cheap. Linear TV advertising is relatively cheap versus, you know, running ads at scale on Facebook in terms of the ROI. So I'm not privy to that, but clearly there is still a huge opportunity with TV. And I think that this, you know, the CTV stuff is about shifting budgets, right, and better measurement and all the rest of it. But clearly there's going to be this lag in terms of all that money coming across because people are going to watch TV in different ways, right, whether it's streaming or whether it's just switching on the TV in the front room to watch ITV or BBC or whatever. Well, not BBC because obviously they don't have any ads. So it doesn't surprise me at all, actually. And it's, if anything, it shows the maturity of the gaming space that they've actually got this far, like, you know, that they're no longer just relying on Facebook to kind of deliver downloads, that they are thinking much bigger in terms of how they build market share and how they get more people to download their games.
Interesting point. Like, you'd think that you see certain companies advertising on TV. Oh, they're desperate. It's strange to see them on TV. Actually, are they being super smart? Is it, have they found a new way of measuring things? And do they know something we don't? Rich, what's your perspective on all of this?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot to unpack there. One of the things I guess I'd want to point out is the difference between mobile games, generally speaking, and console games.
I think absolutely.
If you look at that VentureBeat report, it's probably more focused on the console space. And I think, you know, it makes sense because certainly for some of the Nintendo games where they've been doing a lot of advertising on Nickelodeon and one or two other, I think, Cartoon Network, it's obviously a brand safe environment in which they can reach children, which you can't necessarily do online, given the kind of regulations around advertising towards kids. And then for Sony, obviously, it's super contextual, placing sports related video game ads in the middle of the Super Bowl and on other, you know, ESPN and other channels. So I think in that sense, yeah, it makes a huge amount of sense to have that contextual relevance versus, I think, yeah, mobile games, which are obviously still hugely driven by Facebook ads and other online user acquisition channels. It'd be interesting to see if over time mobile game budgets shift to TV and how they would close that attribution loop. But I think, yeah, the kind of premium contextual nature of those type of TV events, plus the ability to reach the sort of children audience, makes sense.
We have seen King and I believe Peak do mobile game TV ads before. King even had a TV show presented by Mario Lopez of Saved by the Bell fame over in the US. So I think that there's obviously interest in trying to get a more TV space. But yes, you are absolutely right, Rich, that the when you're looking at the companies that are investing the most, they are more doing so from the console perspective than the mobile perspective. And there have traditionally always been big investment from them in the TV space. But the trends of it, and particularly in the increases, are always interesting, and kind of looking at the event space and how that impacts linear versus connected TV budget and investment. Yeah, anyway, I think that that's probably, we've run out of time on that front. I'm very fascinated to get onto the next section. There'll be many of you out there that probably haven't heard of first party capital or what it is. Obviously, you heard Kieran mention that he is also involved in it, so you'll probably hear a bit more about that as well. But Rich, love to find out more about what first party capital is. It's a tongue twister. It is a tongue twister.
FPC
is, and what it is you're up to there.
Yeah, sure thing. So First Party Capital is a collective of senior industry professionals globally that are looking to fund and advise and mentor the next wave of innovation in ad tech, martech, and digital media. So as of right now, we are just over 200 people globally. It's run by myself, Kieran, and Kevin Flood, the CEO of PowerLinks, who is also one of the syndicate leads. And yeah, we saw a huge opportunity to become one of the only sector-focused investment funds, providing capital to companies in the space. And also more than that, you know, a huge amount of advice and strategic value that we can add through the network. There's some of the sort of biggest names in ad tech, CEOs of public companies, people that have sold their companies for hundreds of millions are part of the group and, you know, keen to help our portfolio to succeed. And, you know, on the investor side, we're giving people access to a lot of unique deal flow that they probably wouldn't be able to see through non-sector specialist funds. And also, you know, a lot of the investment will come from folks in the US, and through typical channels, they may not have access to interesting deals in Europe and APAC. So there's a value arbitrage piece there. But yeah, it's been a very exciting journey over the last 3 or 4 months and very well received from both the founders we've been speaking with and the investor community as well.
So I'm fascinated to know, obviously you mentioned kind of as an investor, what you get out of it, kind of access to companies you might not see kind of in the standard markets. But how do you, is it important to have obviously an interest in the space and understand what's going on there? But also as a tech company, why would I want to, what do I get from first party capital that I might not get from trying to raise in other areas?
Yeah, sure thing. So I'd say, yeah, 99% of the people that have signed up so far are very much industry insiders. It's open to non-ad tech people as well, absolutely. But the beauty of it is really, yeah, providing our industry with access to this type of deal flow. And importantly, you know, democratizing that access as well so that you don't have to be super high net worth to start to benefit from some of these exciting private market deals. You know, we're investing in some great companies, some of which have a very real chance of going public or getting bought in the next couple of years. And, you know, those opportunities haven't until now really been available to the sort of larger swathes of the industry. Investors are able to join without any commitment and invest from as little as $5,000 per deal. So yeah, very much open to a wider part of the industry. And on the other side, in terms of, you know, founders in the space, it's yeah, really interesting. We're actually being approached by people that are turning down money from more established investors and VC funds, perhaps because they've had a bad experience from having a VC on their board before, or just because they're sick and tired of trying to explain what their business model is to investors that just don't get it simply. And so as a result, yeah, we're seeing some really interesting and unique deals where companies are preferring to work with first party capital because they know that not only the experience that the three of us have that are running the business, but also access to that network of companies that can help them scale to the US or are looking for board member positions that can really help them drive the business forward. So yeah, I think that kind of capital plus expertise is a hugely valuable proposition. And whilst all investors say that they're sort of strategic and value add, I think the fact that we are so focused on the sector that we know and have done for 10 to 20 years in some cases, is a huge differentiator.
And you mentioned obviously that there are companies that you're working with there that are shying away from going down this traditional raising route of VCs, for example. And it's no real secret that the glut of VCs and PE firms kind of that have descended upon the ad tech industry have created this kind of this interesting trend in valuations, particularly overvaluations for European companies. How does that impact what companies are expecting in terms of how they get valued? And how does that impact how you work with them?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I mean, sort of 2010 to 2015, there was that huge influx of VC capital into the space. And probably over the last 5 years, that's really fallen away. A few investors got their fingers burnt and have pulled out of the space. I think we're starting to see that change. Notably, there's some areas within ad tech like in-game advertising and conversational ad tech where there is a lot of VC money starting to pour in. And that, to your point, is pushing up valuations in areas that are sort of sexy and kind of make sense to sort of non-industry specialists. However, you know, most of the companies we're looking to invest in are actually solving very specific problems for brands, for publishers, or indeed for other ad tech vendors. And in that case, you know, the valuations are probably a bit more realistic because there aren't a huge amount of VC investors that are really speaking with those companies. And yeah, you know, we're working on our valuation model. It's been pretty well received so far by founders. And I think, you know, we're able to come to an understanding of what the correct valuation is for a European company or a company based in APAC. And obviously the goal is to help those companies expand and either get acquired or to expand to the US and see those valuation multiples increase over time. But one thing that has also been an interesting insight is how few investors are actually willing to lead rounds. And what I mean by that is actually do the bulk of the due diligence and, you know, establish that price. It's been really interesting speaking with founders who are or have potentially got soft commitments from other investors, either strategic corporates or angels. But they said, we're only going to invest on the proviso that you find a lead investor to basically, you know, do the bulk of the work and set the price. And certainly in our first three deals, we're leading the rounds and we're very happy to continue doing so. It wasn't something that we thought would be a differentiator, but we're very much finding out from people that it is quite rare for an investor to be willing to do that. So yeah, we see an opportunity there.
Yeah, you tend to get people or companies doing convertible notes, which basically kicks the can down in terms of valuation down the road. But eventually someone has to put a value in the company. And that's one of the things that we've spoke to probably 70 companies now, Rich.
Yep.
And it's just interesting that they want us in those rounds. And to echo like Rich's point that, you know, traditional VCs, there's plenty of money around, Lindsay. There's lots of money to invest. But companies are reluctant to take, you know, the money from VCs because they're asking them to accelerate their valuation. We're obsessed by the unicorn number, right? Because it fits a model. We don't look at it that way. Our fund is open-ended. We don't have to deliver the money back to people unless there's an actual liquidity event that the company sells or IPOs. You know, that's the way we work. And I guess that's what it's attracting the founders to us because, you know, when we talk to them, we're not talking to them as if we don't know what you are. Why are you not a SaaS model? That kind of bullshit VC mindset, it doesn't work in our space because it's very different, right? Look at the companies that actually are very valuable in this space. They're transactional companies, right? Facebook, Google, Snapchat, Pinterest, all transactional business, don't work in SaaS models at all. So we have a very unique perspective of how the industry works. I suppose between the three of us, we've got financial product and sort of like market knowledge. So it's kind of an interesting sort of mix. It's worked very well for us so far. And the reality is that there are so many good companies out there. As Rich's point, like there are obvious narratives like in gaming where there is a ton of money flowing in because they're, you know, because VCs are like, you know, sheep. One runs in one direction. They all kind of run in the same direction, right? But there won't take the time to think about, you know, data governance or the commerce media space and really have a really insightful knowledge of how that all works with the current ecosystem. And I think that's where we're seeing value. We're getting deal flow that nobody else is seeing at the minute, which is great.
And are you able to give the insight into as to kind of what kind of companies you're coming across that are really interesting for you and interesting for your investors and also kind of what regions or markets are producing some really top quality companies?
Denmark!
Yeah, Kieran's going to be really for Copenhagen pretty soon, I think.
Yeah.
yeah, well, the Nordics are throwing out a load of interesting companies at the moment. Of our first six investment, it's likely that three will be in that region.
Wow. But, you know,
we're speaking with companies in the Philippines. We're speaking with companies in Brazil. So yeah, we're very globally focused, open for business globally. That goes for investors and also the companies we're investing in. In terms of our focus areas, I think the name says it all and was a stroke of genius from Kieran. First party capital, obviously, with first party data being such a core thesis for ourselves and also important area in the industry going forward. So yeah, anything around that first party data space, privacy, cookieless is very interesting in the sort of ad tech industry itself. But then also, yeah, we're seeing some interesting stuff happening in what is termed commerce media. So tech solutions built on top of the e-commerce marketplaces like Amazon, helping vendors to better extract data and optimize their keyword bidding within Amazon and the other marketplaces, for example. And then, yeah, I think we're betting big on creative as well. I think with the reduction in the ability of one-to-one targeting, we think that those rich media, very creative experiences that are able to engage users that way are very interesting. And so we're seeing a lot of companies coming forward in that regard. We're speaking with one or two companies in the AR space. Again, it has the potential to be a bit frothy and VCs kind of running towards it, albeit, you know, there haven't been a huge amount of successes in the AR space and it hasn't delivered as much as people might have wanted over the last few years. We are seeing some interesting things there around sort of shoppable content. And finally, I guess, yeah, that data governance piece is something that we're very focused on as well. So one of our first investments will be in that space.
And we shouldn't forget the there's a lot of interesting first-party platforms emerging in certain verticals, which is really interesting. Like, that's the amazing thing. We were seeing companies that we didn't even think existed. Like, so we come across, you know, some companies in audio and who are doing some really, really interesting things from a B2B and B2C perspective, and it's all logged in data. So if you think that ad tech is just building display ad units, then you know you can rightly say to the industry that there's no future in that. But if you think broader about how our ecosystem is going to evolve in terms of like all the different channels, all the different merchant channels, the contextual and the data privacy and ID space, you know, we're seeing loads of great companies and we're going to be investing in contextual, we're going to invest in clean rooms, but there'll be iterations of what we have at the minute and they're really in an interesting space around measurement as well. So, you know, we are seeing, and like, you know, I can see how the existing 1.0 programmatic cookie-based ecosystem is panicking because their world is crumbling. But as Rich said, the sort of a re-emergence of creative tech is great for the industry. It is, honestly, because it just we start believing and loving creative again, like, but from a tech point of view rather than the old creative, what you're kind of merging what we have and not. It's kind of what we talked again about, Lindsay, and those panels where we tried to do creative panels. We're like pulling teeth because trying to put them together. But actually, this is actually Google and Apple's privacy and the GDPR and the US regulation is pushing people towards this new sort of view of how we market to people, like from a creative point of view and first party. So it's really exciting. So, we're buzzing every time we talk to a company. It's just amazing just to have a conversation about their tech.
I can see the enthusiasm. And Kieran, very quickly, in your most concise way possible, as syndicate leads, what are your and Kevin Flood's roles in this company?
Well, we're syndicate leads by name, anyway. We're probably general partners, but we kind of work with Rich to kick the tires of companies, look at the product, look at the market fit, and see how we can help the founders. Because generally, like, the founders really want our insight. Like, and then I guess that's where we add value. You know, Rich has got the tech chops, or sorry, the financial chops, and the experience of working in this business that helps us sort of bring it all together. So me and Kevin, we're committee members, but we're general partners really. But it's that unique insight, because Kevin has deep product knowledge, as do I, but also I have the market and the network. So it all works together really well. Like, and it's kind of like why the syndicate's amazing, because we're trying to bring everything together. And it's sort of like a collective as opposed to like a couple of individuals starting a fund on an LP GP basis, which is interesting, but not really interesting. I'd rather have like 150 people or 200 people or 1,000 people in the syndicate, and there's a massive IPO and everybody's doing well, as opposed to maybe a handful of people, like, you know, the investment bankers in the US who keep talking about how many deals to do, but it's only one guy doing so well. That's not really much fun, is it?
No. Now, question for you. Do you think that was concise?
No.
No. Okay. But it was a good answer. Thank you. That's helpful. Very helpful. And Rich, finally, coming to you. So you're ready to do the first few deals, the first six deals. What then is the next stage after that? Where's first party capital going?
Yeah, so we've got a really strong pipeline of potentially 15 to 20 million pounds worth of investment that we can make based on the current pipeline and conversations we've had. So, you know, those deals will obviously all be made available to our syndicate as soon as those terms are agreed and published through our platform. The second piece that we are looking to launch in the coming months will be a fully fledged VC fund as well. We are starting to see interest from strategic corporates in the space and also other financial institutions that are perhaps less suited to the deal by deal model that works well for individuals and would rather put in a big amount of money and get exposure to a diversified portfolio. So yeah, we're very much hoping we can launch that fully fledged VC fund. It'll still invest in exactly the same deals, but just gives us access to a larger base of investors. And then look, yeah, we try not to get too carried away, but the early signs are really encouraging. S4 Capital, watch out.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to play. That's been really interesting. Thank you. We're going to leave it there. Great note to end it on. Rich, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really interesting.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks a lot for having me on.
And Kieran, thank you, as always.
Thanks, Lindsay. Great to have you back.
Great to be back. Yeah. And that has been the Mad Tech Podcast.